Hello, this is Eric Morris Eskenazi. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode of the Iraq Dispatches podcast, featuring an interview with author Andrew Shanahan discussing his novel Before and After. Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
So do you mind, Andrew, starting off with talking about how you started writing and what were some of your literary inspirations?
Yeah, sure. So from my point of view, my literary inspirations for this particular book, I think it was largely, it was less the literary inspirations and it was more the life inspirations that I'd had and the things that I really felt I wanted to say and I needed to say as a writer. And a lot of that was to do with, I previously was the, I ran an organization called Man v Fat. And that's an organization that supports men all over the world to lose weight and to sort of, you know, get healthy, feel better about themselves. And during the course of that, I interviewed probably in excess of 1,000 men with regard to their weight. And a lot of these guys were people who'd lost weight. Some of them hadn't lost weight. Some of them were struggling with weight, that sort of thing. And quite a few of the guys who I spoke to, or a sadly high number of the people that I spoke to, were what effectively didn't leave the house or actually didn't leave the house for, I think the longest that I spoke to was a guy who hadn't left his house for 9 years. And it was largely because they felt so bad about themselves around their weight. And obviously, you know, weight can then have an impact on mental health and all of those things combined led to these awful situations. And for me, it was really trying to do justice to those conversations that I'd had and trying to give a voice and a space in literature to oversized men, to men who were obese, men who struggled with their weight. And it really didn't feel like it was something that, you know, had been done before. Certainly, I've seen it done in a comedic fashion with things like Confederacy of Dunces, mm-hmm. You know, where you've got a plus-sized male character as the main character. But I certainly never felt like it had been done sympathetically or accurately, I think. And for me, it was really about expressing a lot of the pain and the difficulties that I'd had around my weight loss and the sort of the journey I've had around weight through my life, really. And it was just that sort of experience that informed the book.
And you were like a former restaurant critic or food writer?
Yeah, that's right. So my background is I'm a journalist. I've worked as a journalist for, over 20 years now. And it was during that time I wrote about food, I wrote about restaurants. But I also started up Man v Fat at the same time. And you know, largely I reached the point where I needed to lose weight because of the work that I'd been doing as a restaurant critic. I'm certainly not going to complain about it because it's a very nice way to gain weight. At the same time, it still led to that situation that, you know, I needed to do something about. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, the book was me, like I say, trying to put some of those experiences on the page. And it was an interesting, you know, and then obviously contrasting that. So in the story, what happens is that Ben Stone weighs over 600 pounds. He's been a shut-in in his flat for the last 9 years. He's diabetic and he needs his leg amputating. And on the day that they're taking the front wall of his flat off so that they can use a crane to take him to a hospital. The world ends, essentially. So he's trapped in his flat in this awful situation. And it's about what happens from the end of the world onwards.
When I was reading the novel, I was wondering, were you inspired by any of the books by J.G. Ballard?
Any one in particular?
Like, I don't know. I was thinking of High Rise, of course, because it takes place in a high rise.
Yeah, I've read it. No, I suppose there is something quite nicely claustrophobic about those sorts of buildings where, mm-hmm. you know, there's that strange irony, isn't there, that the further you go up into a high rise, not only are you cloistered further and further into the building because it gets harder and harder to get out of it because you're sort of vertically ensconced within the building, but it opens up the vista ever more. So if you're on, the 11th floor of a high-rise building, then you have these incredible views and vistas over the surrounding area, but you're also more tightly held within the body of the building. Mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting sort of irony, I suppose. But no, I mean, broadly speaking, I've said this before, and I think unusually as a writer, I try not to read a huge amount because I feel that in many ways it's the metaphor that I use is that it's a clean room environment. Your imagination, you know, I feel like for me, I like to keep my imagination free from contaminants from outside. And it's a painful process really, because I adore reading. You know, reading is great joy and has taught me stay out of the way of other writers and their ideas, because I think it can be so, it's less from the kind of word by word plagiarism side of things, and it's more around, I feel like I would have my ideas impacted by other writers, and somehow I don't feel that that's healthy. I feel that, you know, even if you just adopted the posture of other writers or saw which direction they were facing in, or you were aware of trends within the literary world, I feel like it's very, very difficult not to be influenced by those things. So the things that I read tend to be things that I would never in a million years believe that I could write. So, you know, I love female detective novels, and I love the number one ladies detective agency series. You know, just sort of different things, P.G. Wodehouse, things that I couldn't possibly dream of writing. And I feel that that's, I don't know if I'm unusual. I mean, you've obviously spoken to a huge number of writers, Eric. So you tell me if that's something you've seen before.
You know, it's usually like writers will like share like particular other authors or books that inspire them, or life events that inspire them as well.
Yeah. And that's very much the way that I am. I like to be, I like what I write to be informed by the things that I observe and, you know, the novel ideas that I have. And I think that's the enjoyable challenge is trying to sift through those ideas and see which ones are novel. And you know, that's I find that the enjoyable part of the process.
Since the novel takes place in Manchester, are you from there?
Yes, well, I'm from Staffordshire originally, which is just south of Manchester. But myself and my wife both went to Manchester for university and have lived there or thereabouts for the last 20, 30 years. And it's somewhere that I've got a great affinity for. And it feels like it's, you know, a really nice place for fiction to happen, because it's a very, very welcoming small city, but also you tend to find all manner of life there. There's you know, people from every background, every class, every race, and so it's a nice city for that sort of melting pot to exist and for you to weave stories from. It feels like quite a literary city.
I'm more familiar with Manchester with the music. I have a huge affinity for a lot of the post-punk bands that came from there.
Buzzcocks and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Factory Records and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, what happens that in the music industry is similar to how the creative industry is central to Manchester's thought. You know, I mean, Manchester was founded on an industrial heritage of being the cotton-producing center of the empire, the British Empire, So it had a sort of very had a very rich phase during that point. And in many ways that went on to from sort of patrons supporting cultural works, really. So there's a rich history of orchestras in the city. And as you say, that's then followed through. There is a very, very welcoming attitude towards new creations, towards creators as well. There are parts of the city so the Northern Quarter is a place in the city where it's quite cheap to rent. You know, there are places that you can find there so that you can, and these sort of communities build around those places. So it's, I think, as for music, so for literature.
I've been reading like about how the city's changed a lot, like just like London where you live, how air has become very gentrified, and just like here, like in New York City or any major city, artists are being, you know, priced out of these neighborhoods, you know, and people are concerned about that, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's a never turning wheel, isn't it? That's mm-hmm. It's, you can say the same thing for Shoreditch in London mm-hmm. and the Northern Quarter in Manchester. You know, it does go through that, an area of being an area of poverty. Therefore, mm-hmm. artists find that there is a place where they can be and rent for very little money. Then it sort of grows in popularity and mm-hmm. becomes, you know, quaint and appreciated. And then, you know, hipsters move in.
Mm-hmm. for your novel Before and After, you had it, you independently published it, self-published it. Mm.
Sure, I did. Yeah. So my, as I say, you know, my background, I've worked as a journalist for over 20 years. I've published three non-fiction books on a number of different topics and have worked with publishers for those books. So I felt very much that I'd been through the process of working with publishers and going through the authorized, you know, inverted commas, proper route, if you like. And didn't really feel like it fit with my personality. I felt that the there was a, you know, broadly speaking, these were some of the biggest publishing companies in the world that I worked with. And I honestly didn't feel like they brought much to the table. I didn't feel like, you know, the books were made considerably better by their involvement. And then when the books were launched, I didn't feel that there was much in the way of promotion. And you sort of, you become aware of the ecostructure of these companies, where they just have a phenomenal number of books to commission, mm-hmm. produce, and then market. And you realize how inconsequential you are, really. Mm-hmm. To them as a business, and that's fine. You know, that's the way those businesses work. I don't feel chewed up and spat out by them, but equally, having come through that process, I definitely, when I learned about KDP and what the indie publishing platforms were like now, it just struck me that was far more suited for what I wanted to do than anything. You know, then going, because so I've got a literary agent and she was very happy to go and take this book to publishers, but we jointly made the decision not to, because it seemed like there was so much that you could achieve. And, you know, ultimately I want to, like all authors should be, you know, I want to be as in control of the output as possible. That doesn't mean not working with people, and I worked with an editor on this book and would work with editors again in the future. You know, I don't believe that I'm always right on these things, and that's why I don't want to work with publishers. But equally, I think, you know, being an indie author is as close as you can get to a situation where you can put out your perfect vision of what your book should mm-hmm. be.
Mm-hmm. And so far, how has the public reception been for it?
Yeah, it's been phenomenal, really. I mean, far, far better than I imagined. I think my viewpoint was that, you know, being an indie author, you have to go into it with your eyes wide open. And the truth is that there are significantly more books than anyone could ever read, or, you know, really anyone could ever need, possibly. And so therefore, if that being the case, you have to win your share of an audience. And I don't think that that happens overnight. And I think that you have to earn it. It's not winning, it's earning an audience. And for me, I think that that comes about through a process of consistently producing high quality stories, which matter, which are important to you. And I think that audiences and readerships resonate with that. And for me, you know, I very much looked at this as a 5-book process. My own personal viewpoint was, if I can build up a reasonable readership by book 5, then I would be very, very happy. That was my personal viewpoint. And so I was prepared for, you know, before and after to sell very, very few copies across the year. And I'm pleased to say that that's not been the case. It's sold very well. And I think it's just passed 1,000 reviews across Amazon and Goodreads. And it's sort of holding steady at, you know, 4.5 stars out of 5 type mark. And, you know, people have said some very nice things about it, and people who aren't all related to me as well, which is the biggest surprise.
Were there people that have read your novel that, you know, have or are currently struggling with their own weight problems?
Yeah, I mean, one of the early reviews I had was from the British Obesity Society. And I just thought it'd be interesting to get their viewpoint, so I sent them a copy. And they had a really nice review. I'll read you the review. It says, this is a horror story. It's a visceral portrait of addiction and the hope of redemption in a world turned mad by hate and fear. The worst thing is that so much of it is true, a must read. And that was from the British Obesity Society. And I think that, you know, I was really pleased with that because they'd so clearly understood what the book was about. It is a horror story, you know, in a very different sense, in that it's about the horror of, you know, body horror. It is a horror of your own body, a horror of being out of control of your own body. And I think that for anyone who's struggled with their weight, that sense of frustration and, you know, not understanding, or perhaps not necessarily understanding, but not being able to just get your body to do what you want it to do is hugely infuriating. And for many people, that does go on to take the form of horror because they feel consumed by it. So on one side of that spectrum, you might have people who are anorexic, where they, you know, they control to such a high degree, and the control that they feel that they can exert is by having nothing in their bodies. And, you know, the other side is, you know, it's not necessarily a straight spectrum, but at the same time, that, you know, the other side of that compulsive eating and that overeating is where you feel that loss of control, and somehow, you know, food becomes not nourishment, it's a punishment. And that in itself is a horror. So I think that within that world of food and eating, there are a ginormous numbers of just situations that are unnatural and fearful.
I found that there's a lot of elements in your novel that people can relate to now, especially with the COVID shutdown, people being isolated. And then there's been a lot of articles written about mental health issues. You know, people are more depressed or indulging themselves more, like in drugs or eating or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and so the book was written in July 2019, and I think I finished the third and final draft of it in October. And it was published in January. And obviously it's a story about someone who is trapped in their flat while a pandemic rages outside their window. So, you know, I never intended for it to be so poignant, really, because, yeah, absolutely. Lots of people have said similar, that it's a very 2020 book, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You know, that sense of, I think you're right. I think it's interesting the fact that what people have turned to for appeasement and comfort during these times of difficulty, and how often those sources of comfort become a source of pain ultimately. Mm-hmm. So people saying about, you know, COVID-19, the 19 stands for the number of pounds that people are on average are putting on and that sort of thing. And, you know, there is that sort of sense of you treat yourself to, you know, a takeaway or to a, you know, biscuits because mm-hmm. you're feeling trapped and you want that sort of little boost of happiness. And then ultimately, those little boosts of happiness become a major source of unhappiness. It is, you know, truly ironic and, again, quite horrific.
I love all the, you know, the detail with, you know, Ben's love for his dog, Brown, and the relationship with the dog and, you know, like using the drone, you know, it's great.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, great. Well, I really enjoyed writing those bits.
Are you like, have you been approached yet? Or are you open-minded if someone were to approach you to adapt the book into like a screenplay or even into a graphic novel?
Absolutely, yes. So I have been approached and I can't quite say anything mm-hmm. mm-hmm. at this point. But I think I'd love to see other people's artistic take on this as a, you know, a launching point. And I think that's my view on, you know, screenplays and graphic novels and things. I think it's very much a case of the original writer has to step back and let other people do creative things with that as a platform. And so that's very much my approach is, and yeah, of course, like any author, I'd be thrilled to see other people who are feel engaged enough with those characters and those situations that they want to make their own artistic statements about them. I'd love to see that.
I was able to check out some of your previous writings on the Guardian website.
Okay.
And you talk about how with the program Man v Fat, like encouraging people, you know, who like to play football to use that, you know, any kind of exercise. Did you play football yourself when you were younger?
Exceptionally poorly, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not necessarily sporty, I wouldn't say. So the Man v Fat came about. So in about 2014, I lost a considerable amount of weight, but struggled hugely in doing so because I just didn't feel that there was any support that was valid or useful for men out there. And so I went and was the one shady bloke lurking in the Weight Watchers class, you know, getting weighed in. And I remember one week the talk that the leader was giving was about, you know, the difficulties of weight loss during your period. And I was thinking, you know, this just isn't my battle. This isn't a factor that does anything to me. So, but equally, I didn't feel that they were addressing the problems that I did have with weight. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's far more common for men to be stressed at work, for example. Mm-hmm. It's far more common for men to work longer hours at work. And, you know, it was some of those practical things where, you know, I was working very long hours and getting home from work and just speed relaxing with a few beers and a packet of crisps and not making good nutritional choices, even though I knew what good nutrition was. So I felt that, you know, there really needed to be something that just supported men, that there was a gendered approach to that weight loss support. And so I did a crowdfunding campaign and it was very successful. Jamie Oliver backed it and some other celebrities in the UK. And it just grew from there, really. I think by the end of the crowdfunding campaign, we had over 3,000 men who were subscribed to the website and to what it became. And it was really, it snowballed from there because I think, sadly, you know, the need was so great that there was just nothing out there for men. And you know, sometimes people would say to me, oh, it's a really interesting niche. I was thinking, well, a niche implies a sort of a small corner or a, you know, a narrow gap of something. And actually, in the UK, certainly, it's 7 out of 10 men are overweight or obese. So it's actually, you know, in both senses of the word, it's a mass market. Is that, you know, there are a huge number of men who struggle with their weight. And it didn't feel like they were recognized or supported in any way, shape or form. And that's what Man v Fat was there for. So from there, the website built up. We've supported over 4 million men across the world now. We are operating on 3 different continents with some of the football leagues that we run. So we run sports leagues, which are for exclusively for overweight and obese men. And so in the football, for example, the scoring system is based on weight loss as well. So the guys all weigh in before they play their game each week, and they can earn bonus goals depending on, you know, the consistency of their weight loss. And so what that means is that if you're rubbish at football like I am, I could still be a productive member of a team by going in, losing weight each week and scoring my goals that way. And then when I just fell over on the pitch, it didn't matter as much because I'd already been a productive member of the team from doing that. And that's been hugely successful. We sort of partner with a number of football organizations across the world now with that.
Wow. So the NHS, did they ever have any like programs to encourage people to get in better shape, you know, or do you feel that they just weren't doing that enough?
Yeah. Well, the NHS don't really run. It's funny. I mean, given the extent of how difficult and intractable a problem obesity is, the NHS are very passive in terms of the support that they give for weight loss. They're very good at kind of identifying those people who are overweight. But I think because of the scale of the problem, they're a little bit overwhelmed in terms of what would they actually do. So there's very few NHS-based programs for weight loss. And that's really, you know, part of the problem. So Man V Fat does offer a number of programs for men, which can now be effectively prescribed by the NHS. So our government at the moment are on a big drive to help people to lose weight in relation to COVID, obviously, because obesity is such a big factor in the pathways of how that disease progresses. And so they're very keen to help people to lose weight, and they're now referring people to Man V Fat to help them support losing weight.
Wow. Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
Do you mind discussing any upcoming projects you're currently working on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm happy to tell you about, I always feel it's a little bit dangerous for authors to talk too much or in too much detail mm-hmm. about the books that they're writing, not through any sense of plagiarism or worrying about people mm-hmm. stealing things, but from the point of view that I think there's sometimes a danger that the more you talk about something, the less incentive you have for finishing it. Mm-hmm. Where I think that there is sometimes you can expend all of the creative energy that you have for an idea on telling lots of people about it and saying, oh, wow, I think this is a really fascinating idea. And, you know, you have those enjoyable conversations at that point. Whereas, so sometimes I'm a little bit, not secretive, but just cautious in what I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. But so an awful lot of people have asked me for a sequel for Before and After. And I'm very pleased to say that I will be writing one. I'm hoping that before the end of the year, the people who subscribe to my newsletter at helloshan.co.uk, small plug, sorry, they will get a bonus chapter about just a sort of a little bit of an update about some of the things that have happened after the story is concluded. And it's sort of an epilogue of sorts, I suppose. And then the next book that I'm writing, which I'm hoping will be out close to the end of January next year, if I get off my arse and start writing it. I think I'm about 20,000 words into it at the moment, and it's probably going to be about 110,000 words in total, is about the race for Mars, and it's set in the 2030s, and it's broadly satirical, I would say, look at the space race from a global perspective against the backdrop of some fairly dire politics in terms of Brexit and the populism that is rising across the world, and just sort of putting the space race into the for Mars into that context.
Are you a writer full time?
Yes.
Okay, great. Do you mind discussing what do you find to be, as a writer, the biggest joys and challenges?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the biggest joy for me is the actual process of writing. I think, like most writers, I can be squirrelish about actually sitting down and writing. But when I'm actually writing, I find the mental pursuit and the mental activity of writing the purest joy there is in my working life, because that sort of flow state that you enter, where you are connecting the dots, where these plans and thoughts and ideas that you've had start to be fleshed out, I think is just a joy. It's just what I love to do, that feeling of. And also, you know, in that process, I love it when I'm quite a meticulous planner, so I generally know what my characters are going to do and how they're going to behave. But then I love that feeling of when they pull me in a different direction and do something that I absolutely wasn't expecting to do, because I think that's a really nice feeling, because it means that the character is developing his or her own traits, and you feel proud of them in a slightly weird way, that they have the strength of character enough to do their own thing regardless of what you've instructed them to do. So that's always a nice feeling. Was the also the pain of writing as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you belong to like a community of writers and peers in London?
No, not generally. I mean, I'm in contact with a good number of writers. Again, similar to my point about talking about stories rather than writing stories, I think that there is, you know, other authors, and some authors do it and are perfectly successful. I find this is just what works for me, is, you know, keeping my head down, focusing on the story that I'm writing. I tend to be quite workmanlike when it comes to writing. So, you know, I will write for at least 5 or 6 hours a day, and the rest of the time I'll be fairly active in marketing and, you know, the other work of creating sales and that sort of thing. So I find that, you know, I do come across and chat with writers, but that ultimately I don't know how much help that is. I think for some people it's hugely valuable. I just don't find, I have my own process in terms of finishing a draft. There are very small circle of people who read that draft and give me feedback, and then I can build from there. So that's broadly speaking why I don't necessarily, you know, I don't belong to a writer's club or anything.
Can you talk a little about like your decision to how you structure the novel before and after, or how it goes into, like, you know, back and forth to the future and to the past?
Sure. Broadly speaking, I would say it grew out of sort of almost a pun, really, which is that in the weight loss world, before and after photos are, you know, that's what you sell a story on. It's, so if you've got a before photo of someone who looks huge and then afterwards they look muscled and buff, great. Well, there's your story in two pictures. And the structure of before and after the novel is that it looks at Ben's life before this apocalyptic event and breaks that into chapters of looking at different stages and different influences that impacted his weight and his feelings around his weight. And then the story afterwards was broadly looking at what happened after the apocalyptic event and how he responded. So for that, it was, you know, I did a huge amount of research around what is the potential. So without spoiling anything too much, I don't think, Ben, when he is trapped in the flat at the beginning of the book, is completely without resource. He has water, which you know, is available through the taps. He's trapped in the flat. He literally can't get out, and he has no food. The thing that he does have as his resource is that he weighs 601 pounds, and the sheer calorific load that he has in that body fat is what keeps him going. And so I wanted to do a lot of research to make sure that that was scientifically valid and accurate. And, you know, it is, and I'm proud of the research that I did for that. And it's based on things like, there's a famous case study of a Scottish man who didn't eat anything for a year, and in similar to Ben's situation, was literally survived on the body fat that he had. He went from, I think it was about 500 pounds to about 180 across the course of a year. So occasionally people go, oh, well, that doesn't seem realistic. And, you know, it is.
Due to the COVID shutdown, have you felt it's made you more productive as a writer? And also, how has it affected your writing?
Good question. I don't feel like it's impacted me much at all. I mean, where I work, I'm fortunate that I'm completely on my own. It's, you know, a very small studio that I work in, which suits me just fine. And, you know, day to day, I don't really see that many people. So from a personal perspective, you know, point of view, I'm lucky and blessed in that, like that regard. I feel like certainly in the initial stages, clearly there was so much fear and confusion. That definitely had a toll on my mental state of how productive I was being. But ultimately, I think, like all of us, we've all reached this point where we've had to work our way through it and, you know, reach a point where we are at least able to proceed on a day-to-day basis. And for me, that day-to-day basis means I've been able to come into work and write. I think there should be an audiobook coming within the next 6 months or so.
Are you doing the whole book yourself, the audio edition?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Great. Well, I'm not sure if it'd be myself. I think it will be through a company. Okay. But I'll be reading it. Which is great fun. I love radio, and so it's a real thrill to be able to read your own book.
Are you hoping that the shutdown will inspire a lot of people to do, you know, a lot of amazing, you know, artistic work, whether it's writing, film, music, graphic arts?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it's really important that people understand, you know, certainly from your listeners' point of view as well, that, you know, the platforms for independent publishers now are very, very accessible. And there are so many resources out there to support people. I'm a huge believer that everyone should write or paint or create, or, you know, just whether or not they do it as their sole financial business, I don't think it really matters. I think that what does matter is, and I don't even think you have to do it and do it well, I think it's more important that you're doing it. You are in a process of creating, and you are in a process of learning more about that craft. And I think it's hands down the most mentally healthy thing I can think of. And I think from a societal point of view as well, I really think that it's a valuable thing, because the more people create, the more people learn, and the more people, more insights that they develop about themselves and about the people around them. And that has to be a good thing for our world, especially in these times where we have such fractured politics and such difficult, you know, discourses around all of these issues. I think the more that we can create, the more we can understand, and the more we can understand, the more we can progress.
Is like the school system in UK, are they very encouraging for kids to be artistic, or is it more like they're trying to gear them more into a life and working in the corporate sector?
Yeah, I think there is an element of that, but I do feel like, especially at, you know, primary school, so this would be up until around the age of 11, that they do really see what creative work, you know, that matters, and I think it sort of quite quickly gets jettisoned into, you know, once you're go past 11 to 18, but the. And that's a shame, but I think that depending on the school that they go to, that there is always that encouragement. I mean, you know, the one thing great about Britain has, for the last, you know, 200 years, really has been our art and our culture, and the fact that we are, you know, produce some really interesting books, music, plays, art. You know, I think that we punch massively above our weight. And so it would be a travesty, really, if we didn't acknowledge that. And in my view, I think we should capitalize on that more. I mean, there's a big argument over here at the moment about the fact that the arts sector is really receiving no funding during the shutdown, even though it massively and disproportionately affects the arts, because obviously there's no audiences, you're not allowed to do stand-up, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. And I think that's a real mistake, because I think it's arguably one of the few things that we have left to be proud about our country.
Because when I watch, like, you know, films produced in the UK, you have, like, what's it called, like the British Lottery, where filmmakers, mm-hmm. I guess, is it like a funding program where they apply for funding or finishing funds for their films or television projects?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's true. The National Lottery does funding. It seems slightly absurd, though, that we have to rely on, you know, national lotteries, and that the government have such a sort of small pot of money for arts funding. I'm not suggesting that I should get arts funding, obviously, but I just feel that I feel passionately that the arts is something that's worth investing in, and that the value and the revenue that it creates is huge compared to the amount of money that, and also it's not just the financial value, there is a social and the cultural value that is ginormous. And I just think it needs more funding, if anything.
Because I've read stuff about how, like, in the past, a lot of the, you know, teenagers, you know, who would start up bands, like, they would be, you know, signed up to the Dole, and it's like you didn't have much options, but that at least when you're signing on it, you know, if you have the drive, you can do really great stuff. So I'm assuming that the unemployment rate is really high right now in the UK, just like it is here. So
yeah, I mean it's difficult, obviously we're still in the middle of it, so we don't really know, but it's difficult to know how many of those jobs will just reappear once things mm-hmm. are, you know, open for business again. But you suspect that not all of them will be. I think that there was certainly a tradition, perhaps during the 80s, of people signing on to you know, artists who didn't mind about living in poverty, mm-hmm. essentially. They could sign on, get somewhere to live, and just enough money to survive. And that freed up all of their time to focus on music or writing, those sorts of things. That doesn't really exist anymore, because there's such a managed process for people on Job Seekers Allowance, which is the sort of the replacement for the Dole, where they have to be proving that they've applied for so many jobs. And, you know, it's certainly not the artistic grant that it could mm-hmm. potentially have once been considered to be.
Because, you know, there's been talk of, like, universal income. Some cities here in the US are kind of testing that out now. Something I really support. You know, here in the US, we don't really support the arts enough. It's very sad. You know, where people just kind of stuck for years and years at a job they hate, working, you know, corporate thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, universal basic income is a really fascinating idea. And certainly, what's weird is that I haven't seen any kind of research that comes back from UBI studies where they've said, oh, it's terrible, everyone hates it. Or that, you know, it led to this sort of the doomsayers around it say that, well, it would just end up with everyone lying in bed smoking weed and, you know, doing nothing and not being culturally, economically productive. But nearly every study I've seen shows the entire opposite, which is that people become more engaged. They go back to the university and they go, you know, they engage more.
Andrew, do you mind sharing any unusual stories as you were writing your novel before and after?
Okay. So unusual stories. I think the sheer weirdness of publishing a book at the start of a pandemic year about a pandemic year has been very discombobulating. It's been, you know, a friend of mine said, I think your viral marketing campaign for the book's gone a bit far. And it has felt like that at times, that I've had to be really, really sensitive to how I sort of talk about this book and how I market it, because obviously it's an existing and present trauma for so many people, and people have lost loved ones to this. And so if I'm then sort of saying, oh, would you like to read my book about, you know, being stuck inside during a pandemic? Quite rightly, lots of people have said no, because, you know, that's what I'm living, man. And I totally get that. So that has been a very weird situation. I think overall, it's been a positive, it's been a benefit to the book. So I would say the sort of the oddest aspect of this has been what I was saying before about writing a book about someone being stranded inside their home during a pandemic, and then for that to play out on a global scale outside. And, you know, a friend of mine said that I think the viral marketing campaign for your book's gone a bit far. It's felt very much that I've had to be sensitive about how I talk about this book and how I promote this book, because obviously it's an ongoing and present trauma for so many people around the world, and people have lost people that they love to this. And so I have to be very sensitive to that. I think on the other hand, it has been at least shown, you know, the reality of what this book's about. And I feel that, if anything, I feel that the book does have some hopeful and positive messages for the world along those lines, that, you know, even though it's a sci-fi thriller, it's a horror, and, you know, it's a story, I feel like it very much talks about the different sources of hope that people can extract, and how, you know, they can come from all sorts of different sources or all sorts of different places, whether that's, you know, pets, whether it's faith, whether it's music, whether it's exercise, all of those things. I feel like the book does a good job of looking at, or at least suggesting as potential sources of hope.
I hope like the present situation right now in London, are people still taking the COVID virus very seriously, or do you ever notice people just like walking around not wearing a mask, just like, or like there was an article I think in the New York Times recently saying people have pandemic fatigue. They're just like so sick of this, you know, they just want to move on, they're willing to risk it.
I think in the UK, I think the fatigue that's built up is around the disappointment with communication that we've had, because our government has been, their messaging has been very poor, and it's always been last minute. And so it's led to this sort of befuddlement where people aren't quite sure which rules come in when and how they are being employed this week. So I think that's been dangerous, because obviously it's led to this situation where people say, oh, well, I don't know what the rules are, and use that as their excuse for not following any rules. Broadly speaking, I would say that the Brits, we like a rule. We like to, you know, we don't mind it when we're told what to do. I think that there is, you know, globally, I think that the vocal minority has been emboldened by Trump and mm-hmm. by his politics, that they can shout and say anything that they want. And I think the real story in global discourse over the last probably 10 years, there was a quote from a UK government minister called Michael Gove, who said that people are sick of experts. And I think that has been that sort of is an interesting touchstone for understanding the world as it is at the moment. And I think also the death of shame as a political tool. So, you know, I think Trump is a great example of this, where if you refuse to be shamed, then it is very difficult to create any kind of control over people. Because, you know, if I walk into a shop not wearing a mask and refuse to be embarrassed by that, mm-hmm. then it's very difficult for social pressure to kick in. And so I think over here, probably it's 70-80% support people wearing masks. So it is, you know, a very small minority who are saying no. But then if they refuse to be embarrassed, then what power do the 80% have? Mm-hmm.
Is there like a lot of, are there like any news outlets in the UK that are spreading misinformation about the virus, just like here in the US with Fox News?
I mean, obviously Murdoch has his fingers into UK press as well. So through The Sun and I think The Times still. In terms of outright misinformation, yes, certainly the Daily Mail is pretty awful in terms of how they present facts and information, and certainly isn't something that is contributing to the human good, I wouldn't say. Looking at the kind of the media that you guys have, I mean, we're not, as ever, we're probably 5 years behind it, but it's, if Fox, One American Network and all those sorts of things, it's just stupendous.
I'm sure the Brits are just like dumbfounded by how insane things are here in the US with Trump, you know, just, it's scary. Yeah, you know? We're terrified about this election in 2 weeks. We're just like, it can go either way. We don't know what's going to happen.
I don't think it will. I think, you know, I think you're starting to see the Republicans kind of just starting to push Trump towards the airlock so that they can blast him into space. I really do think so. Interestingly, there was a survey yesterday about which way, if we could vote in the American election, what would and it was 82% would vote for Biden in the UK, 18 wow. to Trump, which is interesting. I don't think you've got anything to worry about. I mean, as long as you all get out and vote, I think the left seems particularly ignited. I think Biden is a strong candidate as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I don't know if you watched the town hall side by side,
yeah.
but it was phenomenal seeing, you know, Trump just kind of refusing to answer questions, turning everything into scrappy sound bites and, you know, unfinished sentences, logic that just spindled off into non-existence. And then he turned over and saw Biden formulating 10-minute answers that were deep in policy and information. And it was like watching, you know, sort of a grown-up and a toddler. It was really, really striking. And I think it's going to be so valuable for global politics, because I think, you know, here in the UK, we got American rejects like Steve Bannon mm-hmm. here interfering in politics over here, because clearly they could say, well, look at the success we've had with Trump. So I think a defeat for populism in the US is a really, really encouraging sign that, you know, it could be on the way in globally.
I hope so. Yeah. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hello. Thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break. Thanks again for tuning in to this latest episode of the Erratic Dispatches podcast. featuring an interview with author Andrew Shanahan discussing his novel Before and After. I provided various links on the profile page for this podcast, in which you could check out Andrew's official website, helloshan.co.uk, and also you can purchase Before and After on Andrew's Amazon author page, and also you can listen to him read from the first chapter of the novel on SoundCloud, and also be sure to check out Andrew's Twitter account and the website for Man v. Fat. Thanks again for tuning in. I'll be back soon with a new episode. Take care. Bye-bye.